afternoon, everyone. It's my pleasure to introduce Steve, who's on sabbatical here from the University of Pennsylvania. He's here until May
July
in the FS corridor. I'm sure he's happy to talk to people. He's worked on all manner of wide-ranging things, from hardware and software enforcement of memory safety to the use of linear system F, and in between, today, security programming languages.
All right, thank you. And thank you for inviting me. I'm having a really great time so far on my sabbatical, and I hope that you all feel free to come find me and ask questions. And also, that applies to the talk, too, so please ask questions during the talk. So today, I'll be talking about a programming language called Aura that my group at Penn has been developing over the last several years, and so I want to give recognition to all these great students, and now some of them are postdocs, who have contributed to this work, and also recognize some of the funding agencies who did this. And the general framework that this research is taking place under is what I like to call security-oriented languages. So these are programming languages that have built-in features that make it easier to build secure systems. And so the motivation for the Aura project comes from a very standard problem in today's networked information systems, which is you have some collection of machines, hosts, they're running some collection of applications, they're exchanging data on the network, and you know, data resides at the host but can be shared among them. And what's interesting is, there are many interesting things about this situation, but one particularly relevant thing for security is that some of the data might be confidential or be private to some collection of users who are interacting with this network system. And also, there's a degree of heterogeneous trust in the sense that, you know, some of these machines may be more trustworthy or less trustworthy depending on the context. So if these are your lab machines and these are some random machines on the internet, you may trust these more, for example. And because different principals in the system may have different opinions about trust, it becomes quite complicated to specify their security policies and requirements about, you know, what is actually confidential. So kind of a general the general kinds of questions that this framework raises are, well, how do we deal with complicated security policies, right? First of all, there's just the complications that arise because there are many, many entities, many hosts, different programs, different kinds of data, and so on. Software itself is large and complicated, so how do you know that you've implemented something that's correct? And, you know, because this heterogeneous trust nature of the problem, that implies a certain decentralization in the kinds of policies you want to write down, because not everyone is going to agree. And we have, of course, I'm not the only one to have studied this problem. There are lots of people in this room who've worked on this problem. And there are many existing technologies that address different pieces of this. So, for example, anytime we send something over the network that's untrusted, we're going to use some kind of cryptography. There are network protocols that ensure various kinds of secrecy and reliability properties. At the OS level, we have, for example, firewalls or access control mechanisms at the level of the file system and so on. And so all of these things, I think, are necessary, but they're not completely sufficient because, well, if you encrypt the data, you have to decrypt it before you can perform any complicated processing of it. So you're going to release it to the software. And this has led to a large body of work of trying to regulate information flow through software. And that's a large part of my earlier work. And today I'm going to tell you about some work that tries to integrate information flow with access control and auditing. And one of the motivations is that OS and firewall access controls are often at the wrong level of abstraction for certain kinds of policies, right? They're typically at the blocked, the file handle. For example, your OS provides read-write control access, rewrite privileges on the files, and the firewall provides access control on the packets. But if your policy isn't specified in terms of files or packets, they're specified in terms of objects being manipulated by the program, then it's kind of hard to see how things match up. So they don't quite give you the right level of abstraction. And so that's where security-oriented languages can help, because a lot of the policies we care about are implemented in software. They're enforced somehow through software mechanisms. And a lot of the policies we care about can be expressed properly at the level of the software abstractions. So if you think about it, a particular data structure like that could be used to represent your credit card information, when you serialize it to disk or send it over the network, it's lost a lot of its semantic content. But typically, in an object-oriented language, you would have an object, a class, that represents credit cards. And that dignifies credit cards with some kind of semantic status that the programming language and the policies that you write down about the data it manipulates should be able to take advantage of. So I've done a fair amount of work on this sort of area. And what I'm going to talk about today draws most closely on something called authorization logics and proof-carrying authorization. And there's been a large body of work on this as well. Probably the, some of the earliest is due to Abadi, Burroughs, Lamson, and Plotkin. They have developed an authorization logic, and there's been a kind of continuous line of work in that vein. And some of the most closely related work to the ARA project has actually been carried out right across the street by Cedric and Andy and Sergio Mafis, and where they've looked at type disciplines for authorization. And in fact, that work kind of developed it in parallel to this project, so there's a lot of similarities. Ultimately, as I said, the goal that I would of this project is to connect authorization logics and access control policies to things like information flow. But there's been a lot of other work related to static analyses as well. So the goal of ARA really was to develop a security-oriented language. So it's a programming language that has built-in notions of that support proof-carrying authorization. So it's going to have data types and things like that that help the programmer specify access control policies using a particular authorization logic, and eventually allow us to enforce strong information flow policies within the language itself. So once you've received some encrypted message off the network and decrypted it, how do you know that the program treats it appropriately? And this, I think, is a, why is the programming language approach interesting in this setting? Well, it gives us a way of making the policies kind of declarative in the sense that we can write down a single policy that talks about access control and information flow and let the compiler deal with making sure that it's enforced appropriately. And particularly interesting from the access control point of view is the auditing and logging that the proof-carrying authorization, which I'll explain in a lot more detail in a few slides, lets us do. And setting all of this on a good theoretical foundations has some nice benefits so we can understand the kinds of things that are possible with our authorization logic. So in the rest of this talk, I'm going to give basically a tour through ARA's design. And I'm going to focus mostly on the authorization and auditing components. And I'll talk a little bit at the end about information flow, but there's too much to pack in, so ask me questions about that later. Okay, so here's the outline for the rest of the talk. I'm going to sketch basically pictorially the programming model that we have in mind for ARA software. And then I'll dive into the authorization logic, actually a simplified version of it, and give you a feel for what I mean by an authorization logic and how you use it in the programming language. And then I'll wrap up at the end with some of the things we're currently working on and where we're going with this. So here's the ARA programming model. So ARA is a type-safe functional programming language, as in any other kind of type-safe language. There's some kind of interface to the underlying runtime system, which mediates access to network, disk, resources of all kinds. And Aura itself is intended, well, at the moment it's rather a prototype, but you could imagine using it for writing the security critical components of your system, and it would have to link against non-security critical pieces. So far this looks completely standard for any kind of type-safe programming language. What Aura provides in addition to that is a first-class notion of policy, which is basically available at the same level as the code. So when you're developing your program in Aura, you can also write down policies. And these policies themselves are expressed in an authorization logic that is closely tied to the programming model. So applications can define their own policies. The Aura itself is agnostic with respect to what kind of policies you're trying to enforce. It doesn't care. And basically what Aura does is provide a bunch of features that let you create and manipulate proofs in this authorization logic that can be passed around as evidence. So what does that look like? Well, proofs are first class, and they can depend on data in the program. And what I mean by that is if your program is, say, manipulating credit cards or files or something like that, then the proofs can mention the program representations of the credit cards and files. And moreover, those proofs are essentially the representations of capabilities that are needed to access resources associated with, protected by the runtime. So if you wanted to, for example, access the file system, you might need to provide a proof that the program that's currently running is allowed to, say, delete the file or write the file. And what part of what Aura does is check to make sure that the policy is well-formed and the proof you provide is correct in the sense that it complies with the policy. And the other thing that the Aura runtime system does is log the proofs so that you can later audit them. Now, the other thing that Aura does, and this is getting at the distributed or decentralized aspects of this problem, is if you're going to communicate to some other instance of the Aura runtime across the network, there's going to be some communication over the network. And typically that's going to involve exporting bits of these proofs to make requests in a decentralized way. And to enable that, the Aura language provides the notion of a principle. So a principle you can think of as some runtime entity, here A or B, that's associated with a piece of code and grants that piece of code the authority to carry out certain kinds of privileged actions. So if you're used to thinking in terms of Unix, you have root and user principles, and you can think of A and B as being analogous in the Aura setting. And what's interesting is that Aura internally manages a set of, one possible implementation of Aura would be to map principles to private keys. And then Aura, the runtime system, will manage these private keys for you. So as the programmer, you think in terms of principles, and all the use of cryptography is hidden beneath the abstraction provided by the Aura programming language. And how you implicitly manipulate those keys is through this notion of principle, which is connected very tightly to the authorization logic. So you'll be able to create proofs that this code running up here as A can generate, but this code running as B couldn't possibly generate. Intuitively, because this code can use A's private key and this one can only have B's private key. Okay, so that's great. Why all this business about proofs and logging? Well, I think it's because if you look at the programming, or if you look at the computer security literature, audit is usually considered one of the most important components of creating secure systems. But there turns out to be relently little research on what to actually log, how to audit it, and so on. So the fact that we're explicitly manipulating policies and proofs gives us a strong handle on what kinds of things to log. Whenever the runtime system uses a proof as a capability, it should log that information and timestamp it and make sure that it's okay. So that's just nice. I think where it becomes more interesting is when you imagine these proofs getting, or these policies becoming more complicated, because we have hundreds of users and lots of delegations and very complicated chains of authority, then it's probably going to be the case that the policy becomes inconsistent or at least incorrect in some way. And being able to detect when that happens is enabled by logging. So here I'm imagining that this red piece of policy shouldn't be there. It was misconfigured or somebody created a certificate that they shouldn't have. And when that gets used by the system, it'll get logged, and then you can go back and later audit and say, hey, wait a minute, how did Bob get access to this file? Well, Jane said he could, but she's not supposed to say he could, so there's a problem with the policy. And the other reason why having these explicit evidence is good is because it reduces the trusted computing base, right? The interface between the runtime system and the rest of the code is protected in the sense that this code, the code that's running up there can do anything it wants, but it can't forge proofs. Proofs are universally agreed upon, what it means to be a good proof. And that means you can't spoof the system by writing some bad code, assuming that the ARA type checker is correct. Okay, so that gives you a flavor, I hope, at a very high level of how the programming model that ARA is intended to give. And so now I want to talk a little bit about the authorization logic and some kinds of examples to make this more concrete for you. So what is an authorization logic? Well, an authorization logic is a logic. So we have what you could call propositions, but I'll call them policy assertions or policy propositions because these are the things that you use to write down the security policy. And it consists of a bunch of kind of standard things, implication, conjunction, disjunction. You can quantify over other policies. And what makes this an authorization logic is these two kinds of propositions here. So first, we have this proposition A says fee, and this is what connects the notion of principle to the notion of policy. So if you have the file system says Steve can read file foo, you can write that down as a policy by having A be the file system and having some proposition where the can read is one of these constants. I'll show you another example of that on the next slide. So what's important about ARA's particular authorization logic? Well, it's constructive in the sense that all of when we create a proof in this logic, we're going to have evidence for the fact that that the proposition is true. And that's compatible with a kind of open worlds assumption because in a distributed system, you never know when you're going to learn some new fact, right? Somebody on the other side of the network could create a new policy that you weren't aware of, and the only way you can learn of it is through evidence. And so that leads to a kind of a constructive way of treating these logics. And the other thing that we're going to do is, in constructive logic, proofs are programs, and R is a programming language. So we're going to let you write down proofs exactly like you write down the programs, so that you're using the same syntax for both kinds of things. And that makes it a little bit easier, I hope, for people to deal with passing around these proofs. And a lot of this, kind of the core ARA, is inspired by this core calculus of dependency that Abadi proposed as an authorization logic. I think 2006. And I should point out that actually what I'm showing you here is sort of a simplification of the real ARA, which builds in data types and a bunch of other things just to make things kind of uniform across the programming language gives you an ML-like data types, and so the logic gives you similar data types. And we use those to encode AND and OR and so on. So how does this authorization logic work by example? So we might have some file system setting where we have a principal file server, FS, and we have some propositions about who owns which files. So we might have a proof P1 that the file system says A owns the file F1, and another proof P2 that the file system says B owns F2. And so if you had a whole collection of these things, you can imagine that's one way of implementing the ownership field on the file system. And we could have read and write and so on. And we might want to implement an owner controls read policy. And what I mean by that is, if the file system says that for all owners, readers, and files, if O is the owner of F, and O says that some reader may read F, then F may read the file. So this is a kind of logical assertion that uses quantification to express that the file system is delegating to the owner of the file the ability to express the read permission. And now we're implementing some application, and we may need to create a proof that the file system says that A can read F1, for some example. And we know from up here that A owns F1. So what are these owns and F1 things? Well, those are those constants that I talked about. So owns and may read are just constants. But one important thing from the logical point of view is that I told you this is a constructive logic. There aren't any inhabitants. There are no proofs of those things. They're just parameters of the system. So there's no proof evidence associated with those kinds of constants. And that's good, because otherwise it would be easy for people to just make up facts that aren't necessarily true. On the other hand, if some principle A should be able to create a proof, a real proof of the fact that A said B may read the file. That's a matter of policy, not fact. And so A should be able to just create whatever sort of arbitrary policies they care about. And as I said before, in kind of the decentralized implementation of all of this, you can think of a proof that A says T is really A's digital signature on the string T. And I'll write those digital signatures like this. A says sign T. Sign AT. So one of the interesting things about this kind of setup is there can be lots of different proofs of the same proposition, right? And that's part of why logging is interesting, because if you have different proofs, the proof content can tell you something about the nature of what happened in the system. So here, for example, if we needed to construct a proof that the file system says that A can read file 1, well, one way to do that is just somehow get a digital signature signed with the file system's key, private key, on that string, A may read file F1. And if that showed up in your log, that might be a little bit fishy, because why would the file system be directly creating such things? Maybe that's the way the system is intended to work, maybe not. So that's one proof that the file system says may read A F1. Another proof involves this owner controls read thing. So remember, we had this proposition, this proof P1, that said that file system says A is the owner. And we know that the owner can allow someone else to read the file as long as they say that that other principal can read the file. And so here in this red is kind of an ugly proof term that uses the owner controls read proposition. And inside it, we have a digitally signed piece of evidence, which is that A has signed the proposition A may read F1. And that's a very natural thing. If A was requesting permission to read its own file, you can imagine A signing, I want to read, A may read it, and then binding all that together to create a proof that you can then check. According to the ARA type system, this little piece of proof will have the same type as the previous simpler proof. Now, if this showed up in the log, we'll see this kind of digital signature, and that may or may not be interesting from the point of view of logging. In this case, I would think that this particular signature seems more reasonable than the other one. Okay, so as I said, we have to create these digital signatures, and the way that happens in Aura is with this notion of authority. So every piece of code is running with the authority of some principle. For simplicity, in all of our theory, we limit it to one principle, but you could generalize it. But the idea is that the authority models possession of a private key, although the program never explicitly manipulates keys. And there's a program operation, say, fee, which basically uses that private key internally to construct a digital signature on that proposition. And now there's a question, we're trying to use this to allow programs to create policies. What propositions should a program be able to say? And here, there are lots of reasonable things you could do. Aura is agnostic. It doesn't put any constraints at all. So a running program can say anything they like. And it turns out that that's okay in a very technical sense that I'll explain in just a minute. But you might start to feel a little bit suspicious. Well, couldn't the program just start saying crazy things? And yes, it's true. But you could also limit the set of propositions in various ways. So you could restrict the set. So saying a proposition is like enabling that capability because you're creating a piece of evidence that can then be used in some other proof. And so you could just statically restrict the set of capabilities that can be enabled by a given program. And actually, that's quite similar to the Java privileges model, where you statically write down a list of privileges that can be created by Java's runtime system. Or you could determine it dynamically somehow, or you could audit it. In any case, you log one of these say events, so you have a record of the fact that this new fact was introduced into the environment. And the fact that we're basing all of this on an authorization logic lets us use the logical properties to derive some interesting facts about the Aura system. So one interesting thing is that principles assert all true statements, or in other words, principles are rational. So it's a theorem in the logic that if you have some proposition T, then P will say it. And principles assertions are closed under deduction. This is just a kind of natural consequence. So if P says T and P says that T implies U, then P will also say U. So this means that you can write policies that involve complicated logical reasoning from P's point of view. And the interesting thing from the expressiveness of the logic is that Aura allows you to define propositions. So one very common one in the authorization logic literature is P speaks for Q. And intuitively, all this says is that Q is delegating their powers to P, right? So in other words, if P says something, then Q is also willing to say it. So I've handed it, if P speaks for Q, then anything P says, Q is willing to go along with. Right, so we can define this notion of P speaks for Q. And it turns out that in this particular authorization logic, but not all, it's a theorem that if Q says that P speaks for Q, that in fact P does speak for Q. And this is sometimes called the handoff axiom. And one way of thinking about what this means is that Q is solely responsible for delegating his authority to P, right? So Q can hand off control to P. And you could imagine making refinements of this. Q says that if P is about files, then P speaks for, if the proposition is about files, then P speaks for Q. that sort of thing. This handoff axiom typically has to be, well, it's an axiom in some of the early work on authorization logic, whereas here it's derivable. So that says that we have quite an expressive authorization logic. What's also important from the point of view of the logic is what you can't prove. And here is getting back to this idea that programs can just issue whatever assertions they want. So, for example, you can't prove false. This authorization logic is consistent. That's reasonable and reassuring. Without using a digital signature, you can't show that P says false. So this means that unless they're willing to kind of assert that they're crazy, the principles in the system aren't going to say something bad. And here's another theorem that's not possible to prove. So if A says some proposition, then A, then alpha. So this basically says that just because some principle asserted a fact, it doesn't necessarily hold, right? So what principles say are a matter of policy. They're not truth. And here's the one that's important from the point of view of allowing arbitrary code to issue whatever assertions they want. So if Q is different from P, so we have two different principles running in the system, and there's no digital signature in the proof, then there's nothing that Q can say that causes P to say false. So what that means is that nothing Q can say can put words into P's mouth. Right, so that's important, and the only way that this could happen, even in the presence of sign, is if P delegated some powers to Q. So if Q speaks for P and Q says false, then P would say false. But this is basically capturing the fact that there's no delegation unless there's explicit digital signatures witnessing that fact in the system. Okay, so that's quite a bit about the authorization logic. So how does this fit in with the kind of programming part of all of this? So here's kind of a picture of how the Aura programming language decomposes. So on the left, in green, we have programs. And there's the dynamic part, which is what you run, and the static part, which is just the type system. As usual, this is a typed language, sort of like ML and so on. And on the right, we have policies, which also have a static and dynamic part, right? So the dynamic component of policies are these proof evidence, the digital signatures and those bind terms that glue digital signatures together to create more complicated capabilities. And the static parts are those propositions, like the file system says A owns P and so on. And what's kind of interesting is that for example, this file handle is actually one of these dynamic program terms. So technically, R is a dependently typed language. And there's another subtle component, which is that the static type system of the program world includes a type of proofs. So it kind of imports all of these propositions as proofs that you can, as the data type of proofs that represent those propositions that you can program with. Right, so as I was saying, the policy propositions can mention program data. So if F1 is some file handle, it could actually appear in the policy. And Aura actually uses a very restricted form of dependent types. It allows only dependency on first-order data. What that means is basically you have to have a simple, well-defined notion of equality over these things. Otherwise, type checking becomes very difficult. And it doesn't allow much computation at all at the type level. So if you're used to programming in a very rich dependent type system, you'll feel impoverished here. And it includes dependent pairs or dependent records and dependent functions, which are used to give types to the file to the interface where the runtime system requires logging, and I'll show you that in just a second. One nice invariant that Aura maintains that kind of falls out of all of this is that digital signatures appear only on types. You never actually sign. So if you think about just the act of using a digital signature on a piece of bits, you could digitally sign the value 3. But from the kind of semantic level, that doesn't mean very much, because what does it, A says 3 is not really, it doesn't make sense as a proposition. But it actually turns out not to be a restriction. What it means is you're forced to think a little bit more about why you're using the digital signature, and you use a predicate to say, to give the semantic content of why you're signing that. So if for whatever reason 3 was good, you could say X is, 3 is an integer, and A says that 3 is good. And then good would have a kind of semantic meaning from the policy point of view. So that's one nice thing that I was kind of surprised by that fell out of this. And it turns out that this seems to be a fundamental difference between using encryption for digital signatures, at least in the Aura context, and using encryption for secrecy in the Aura context. So how do these dependent types help with this access control thing? Well, so let's just imagine we wanted to expose the file system primitives in an Aura manner. So internally, the OS provides some raw read operation that maybe takes a file handle and gives you a string. The particular details aren't very important. The way we would expose that in Aura's runtime is to essentially wrap this raw read in a little, in a way that it takes an extra proof and returns some extra proof information. So the type of read in Aura is give me F, which is a file handle, and a proof that the runtime says it's okay for self to read F. And I'll return an answer, which is a string, the same string that would be read up there, and a proof that the runtime said that it did read that file handle and get that answer. Now, this self is a principle that's built into Aura, and it basically names the authority with which the current code is running. So as I said, all code is running with some authority. You name it by saying self. It's a little bit like saying, the authority of this running program. So what this means is that when you call the read operation, this is running with some principle's authority. The runtime has to agree that that's okay for the currently running program to read that particular file handle. And if so, you can call this read operation. If you can't somehow construct this proof, then you just never can call this read operation. So this is something that's a little bit different from traditional access control. You can't fail dynamically in the sense that read itself won't fail. You'll just never be able to call read because you won't be able to construct the appropriate proof. And then the runtime returns some information that may or may not be useful for enabling other propositions. And here, these okay to read and did read are sort of generic policies that are sort of uninterpreted from the Aura point of view. And the way the application implements its own policies on top of this, and then you have when you install the application, you make a delegation that says that the Aura runtime says the application code is allowed to make policies regarding okay to read. So you can use the delegation mechanism built into the authorization logic itself to bootstrap a kind of generic policy that works for any, that's not tailored to any application, and say, well, the runtime system is saying that the program can institute its own policy. So here's just a piece of code that's an example that's trying to, show you that it's somewhat real, and this is basically walking down kind of an access control list as it would be implemented in Aura. And I don't really want to go through all of the details, and you haven't seen the concrete syntax anyway. I just want to highlight a few of the kind of key features here. So up here at the top, we have a way of creating policy assertions that are particular to a given application domain. So here we would have the owns and may read predicates, and we write down their types just as you would write down any other types in the programming language. So here, owns takes a principle and a file handle and is a proposition that you can mention in other propositions, and similarly for may read. And here's the delegation from the runtime system to the file system. So this says that if f is a file handle and p is a principle, the file system says may read p implies that it's okay to read the file system f. So this is this handoff from the runtime to the application-specific policy parts. And then we can write some code that might handle a request, and the idea is we would look at the kind of request we're getting, and maybe it's a request to read a file, and part of that request would be some file handle and some principles. The queue is the principal who's doing the request, and we need a proof that, in this particular case, the owner of the file, the alleged owner of the file, according to the request, says that Q may read F. And just because the request came with an assertion that somebody was the owner of a file doesn't mean that that's the case. So we might have to check by looking up the owner of the file, you know, asking the file system who's the owner. And we get back some other owner. And we need to dynamically test whether they're the same, because if I'm looking at the file and giving you a proof that's, you know, that Peter said I could read the file, when the file isn't owned by Peter, then that should fail. So here would be one place where you could get a dynamic failure, basically because the owners don't match. But if they are the same, then in order for all of this code to type check, you have to refine the types of the proofs in the body of the if statement so that everything is well typed. So basically it means that when we check for a runtime equality between dependent data, we need to reflect that in the type system. And so this bit over here is kind of a, you know, constructs a proof object, and then finally we've gotten all the stuff we need to read the, you know, the file with the capability. So it's a bit verbose, but it works. So what's the status? So, well, what I've covered today is kind of a simplified version of ARA. We have a core calculus formalized in Coq. It actually gives a much richer type system than what I described here. And we have a complete proof that the type system is well behaved in Coq. So we know that the language is sound, and type checking is decidable, largely due to these restrictions on the kinds of dependency that we have. And we have an implementation in F sharp and an interpreter that works with lots of smallish examples. And here we're really not proposing that this be used in practice, but mainly is to get an idea with proof sizes and how hard it is to implement the logging infrastructure. And there's a lot of interesting future questions that I'll get to in a minute. And we have a bunch of papers that describe ARA system, two of which I haven't really had time to talk about today. So everything I've been telling you is really focusing on what I would like to call the integrity aspects of authorization and the policies. So the digital signatures and the access control are all about checking the validity of the requests and the capabilities that are being used. Of course, cryptography is often used to protect secrets as well, so to enforce confidentiality policies. And I mentioned at the beginning that in the long run, we're, you know, ARA is interested in trying to enforce information flow policies, which talk about, well, once you've got a secret into the system and you do some computations over it, how do you know you haven't covertly leaked out that secret? It turns out that there are kind of two different directions we've explored with looking at confidentiality in the context of ARA. One of them is, well, it turns out that Aura's type system is expressive enough that you can code up confidentiality policies. And the rough idea is that if you want to have a secret in Aura, you can create a data type that wraps the secret in a closure, and the argument that the it wraps it in a function, and the argument to the function is a proof that you're allowed to see the secret. So you can connect the access control bit that I've been describing today to essentially the declassification operation of the information flow policy. So if you do that, you can write down Aura programs that compute over secrets in a very natural way. And we have a proof that, assuming that you don't have any of the capabilities for declassification, which would allow you to get access to the secret, that in fact you can't. So there is no way to kind of use the system in some brittle way that leaks the bits of the secret in some bad way. This proof only works within a single Aura virtual machine, because as soon as you possibly send these closures around the network, then there are all sorts of ways you can learn secrets by traffic analysis and padding and channels and all sorts of things like that. So that's one interesting direction to go. Jeff Vaughn, a PhD student of mine who did a lot of the work on the Aura project, looked at another approach to enforcing confidentiality, which is to look at, so there's this very appealing kind of symmetry here. We're saying that digital signatures, A says P, the digital signatures kind of witness that proposition. And you would like to have a kind of symmetric thing that says, well, I have some data that's only supposed to be for A, right? And so that would be a way of packaging up encryption at the level of types. And it turns out that you can push this through. It's surprisingly more complicated. And because of the fact this strange difference between we only sign propositions, but you would like to encrypt actual data, the symmetry is not as regular as you would like. But Jeff's dissertation shows that you can make sense of this. And it allows some interesting things, like you can actually compute in a sort of lazy way over these encrypted bundles. And then when you finally get the data to a place, so here this is T is a piece of data that's secret to A, you can compute over it. And finally, when A gets it, they can run this kind of computation and extract the underlying data from it. And it turns out that that's another nice way of kind of encapsulating the encryption. But they're not really particularly compatible in a way that we've been able to see yet. So that's one question, is whether these two approaches can be combined. But there's also a lot of other future work and open questions. So a lot of it has to do with implementation. We have it, like I said, we have a prototype, but it's not really industrial strength. There's just proof representation issues. So especially if you want to use Aura in piece of the program and then interface to some less trusted piece of code, we already have the mechanism built in place to allow you to import proof objects, for example, over the network. You just have to dynamically type check them when you load them into the Aura runtime. It's not easy to. Aura provides facilities for manipulating these proof objects. Other languages have to basically treat them as black boxes, and it's not so convenient. There's a lot of work about efficiently implementing the logs, because if you do this naively, you log a lot of data, and you probably don't want to log all of the data that we're currently logging, according to the specification. For example, if you write to the file and you write a megabyte, the log is going to include the contents that you wrote. That's clearly not desirable. But you need a way to compress that information and represent it efficiently. And there's a lot of interesting questions to do with the distribution here. So one thing that I've kind of swept under the rug is that the policy assertions that all of these principles are making have these constants like owns and may read, and they, just like in any other system, there's a versioning problem where they all have to kind of universally agree on the set of propositions and their types so that they are speaking the same vocabulary. And Peter has done some work, for example, on solving those kind of issues in distributed systems, but it would be interesting to apply that here. Another thing that I haven't really talked about, and you may be wondering, is, okay, so I'm treating these proofs as capabilities. One of the standard problems with capabilities is revoking them. So there are several different possibilities there. One is to, that we've basically implemented in our prototype, is to include a timestamp in all these digital signatures. And that is a simple and pragmatic thing. When you check the validity of a proof, you check the timestamps to make sure that they're still in the allowed, they're still live, basically. But it also breaks the logical coherence of the meaning of the propositions, because now when you say A says Steve may read the file, there's kind of behind the scenes implicitly, you know, until next Wednesday or something in there that's not exposed at the level of the proofs or the propositions. So Deepak Garg and Frank Fenning have done some work on adding time stamps in a nice way to these authorization logics. We haven't really tried to adopt that yet. And then just from a programming language engineering point of view, we're doing dependent types here, and our prototype interpreter eschews all type inference. Well, not all. It does very minimal type inference, as you could tell from the verbosity of the code that I showed you. I think, you know, type inference for these kind of dependently typed languages is a very interesting problem. Here, we're manipulating proofs explicitly, and that gets to be kind of a pain. Aura has a very expressive logic, so actually deciding whether a proposition is true and constructing a proof is undecidable. That's okay, because we don't try and find them for you anyway. It's up to the programmer to figure out how to search for the proofs in whatever domain-specific way they want. So in the file system example, you probably would have a little, you know, the link list of access control, the access control list associated with a file, you would just search it. And if you couldn't find one, you would just say, couldn't create the proof. Of course, that's not complete. So, you know, there's proof inference, and you can imagine cutting down the expressiveness of Aura to allow for complete or decidable proof inference. And there's lots of other questions about, you know, for example, how do we correlate the information that's on all these distributed logs that are being generated? So I think I'll just wrap up there and say that, you know, I hope I've taught you a little bit about Aura and the notion of authorization logic and how we combine it with dependent types to provide a programming language for building more secure systems. And you can find all those papers and some distribution, I don't know if it's the most recent one, of Aura at this webpage. So, thanks.
Microphone game.
How do you see that this concept would expand to privacy properties rather than security properties?
So privacy is a bit tricky. I want to make a distinction between confidentiality, which I think of as protecting secret data, and privacy, which I think of as protecting relationships among principals. So the fact that you interact with a particular doctor is something that's private to you. So I haven't really thought about Aura in the context of that notion of privacy, if that's what you're thinking of. But if you're thinking it.
Well, often in privacy, the question is not, do I get access to the data, but do I get access to for data for a specific purpose. For instance, you give out your email address, but only to get delivery confirmation and not for being spammed for the next 2 years.
I see. So this is kind of a selective delegation. in the sense that you're willing to hand out your email address, which is like a capability to send mail, but only in certain for certain contexts. So in Aura you can write down some forms of selective delegation in the sense that you can limit the speaks for proposition to particular domains of propositions. And so if you could somehow shoehorn the capabilities that you're talking about into that framework, then yes. But I think in general that's hard. And also, in some ways, that kind of delegation doesn't fit with the logical structure of the authorization logic we have here. So my short answer would be, I haven't thought too much about it, but my intuition is you can't really do it.
I was just wondering about the life cycle of logs. So it sounds like they're kind of in an append-only structure at the moment, but presumably once the values that they refer to have been garbage collected away by the runtime, the logs themselves can be collected or compacted somehow as well.
Yes.
So does the runtime do
this? So currently this is kind of going with the optimizing log stuff, and we've done very little about that. So one thing you might hope is that the way things are currently set up in Aura is the actual operations that get audited tend to refer to persistent things that are outside of the virtual machine. And so then whether or not they're garbage collected and so on is kind of irrelevant, is independent of Aura's mechanism. So we can't say anything about that. And there really wouldn't be too much point in auditing something that's just ephemeral for the duration of a single run of a program. You could certainly use Aura's type system to create a policy about those purely dynamic things and check it by writing down your own, a module interface that requires a permission. And unless you explicitly logged it yourself to some persistent storage, which we do provide, I didn't mention, it's trivial to add a log operation which takes a proof and gives you nothing and writes it to the log, but it itself is an operation that requires permissions. So anyway, you can set it up so that you could choose to audit or not those things and choose to log or not certain events in the program.
Right. I just had a quick follow-up question. What is the security ramifications of an attacker analyzing these logs? Do they also have to be held securely?
Yes, have to secure the logs as well. It turns out that that's one piece of auditing literature that actually exists. There's a fair amount of work on cryptographically sealing logs and doing it efficiently so that you can share log infrastructure. And then eventually you want to audit them, so you have to be able to query over these encrypted things. But the story for Aura at the moment is there's basically an external private key, kind of super user or root or whatever, that the logs will be encrypted under. And if you want to audit those logs, you have to have that key. And that's kind of external to all of the language stuff that I've been talking about and not really mentionable in the language itself.
Thanks.
So you can't reflect on the logs in Aura, which that would be crazy. Possible, maybe, but I haven't. So the question is, whether
you could actually use the Coq mechanization as a type checker itself.
Yes. So the question is, do we get a lot of benefit from Coq? And the answer is an unqualified yes. Mainly because there were four or five students working on this and having a repository where they could all collaborate on proofs and change things without, having to redo all the paper proofs or figure out where we need to check things. So that was helpful. During the development of Aura, we iterated many, many times on the type system and, trying various ways of setting things up. And so that also benefited a lot from the mechanized meta theory. The other nice place where it worked quite nicely was, so we basically did all of the main Aura proofs, and then We did this encoding of information flow with Lemin, and Jeff made an extension to the language to handle this encryption stuff. And being able to sort of fork the meta theory development and work from two well, you know, sort of from this well-established foundation, and, it was very helpful. So Jeff, all of his proofs in his dissertation were completely mechanized, and he proved a weaker non-interference theorem that says, you know, it's a kind of a secrecy thing that says that encrypted data can't be released unless you have the key. He was able to prove all of that in Coq in a relatively short period of time by extending our original development. So it was a clear win. And we did find lots of bugs in our, you know, formalism. And yeah, so it was great. But a lot of work. So it's a trade-off. Right. So Coq is not, so we did, as part of the development, we would say, okay, here's a program. It should type check. Can we do it manually? It's very, very, very painful, mainly because you have to apply the rules essentially by hand unless you want to implement a type checker in LTAC. And so we were able to get very small test cases to go through to say, here's what I think this should type as, but they're really like micro benchmarks, not anything interesting. So,
another question. So, this access control is only inside Aura's runtime system. Have you thought about integrating it with mandatory access control systems in operating systems, extending them somehow?
Right. So, we haven't thought about how you would integrate this with more closely with OS mechanisms like that. You might be able to implement interesting pieces of an operating system using something like Aura by essentially putting some of its proof-checking mechanisms into the operating system and using its notion of proof as the capability. We haven't, I mean, that's one possibility. I don't know if that would really work in practice because the proofs are kind of big. But yeah, so we haven't thought, we've thought basically about Aura as a wrapper for underlying resources and not the other way around.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I think one of the reasons not a lot of literature talking about what you do, or how do you do audit in operating systems and firewalls, is that it's considered a well-understood area. They've existed for 20 or 30 years, but all the research focus has then been on what do you do with the information you get from the audit systems. There's a lot of it in intrusion detection, especially.
Right.
And I noticed on your to-do list was kind of techniques for mining
right.
audit data. I wondered what you plan to do with the audit data, especially.
Well, so one of
the OS experiences, you get a lot of it in a hurry, and then you're kind
yes,
of stuck
so
with it.
You get a lot of audit data. But one of the interesting things that we have here is we have the proofs, and there's actually logical content to them. So you can imagine looking for inconsistencies or doing kind of meta theory of the policies that you've written down in the logic itself and using the logs to help find inconsistencies in the policy, for example. Like, you might, for example, say Alice should never be able to read the file as kind of a sanity check on your system. And then, you know, try and prove that you can never create such a capability that would allow her to do it as part of this. So that would be one way of auditing the system. Extracting useful information from logs. Basically, I would look for the digital certificates, the kind of basic certificates in the logs, and use those to try and answer queries of, you know, or trigger alarms. If Alice is not supposed to read the file, and she did, now you can. You should be able to query against the log and look at the set of digital signatures that entailed that access, and then through that, kind of chain back to find out which of them was at fault. That's the sort of thing that I'm imagining.
Right. And that's fairly in line with things people do with operating systems, because when we build operating system audit trails, we include the access control information that led to the resulting failure. Yeah. So you can then say, oh, look, well, the permissions in the file were wrong. How do you get in that situation? I guess I might encourage you to think temporarily about the types of assertions that you can make. It seems like the proof system is very placed in the present, which is interesting.
Right.
And
this,
useful
this
for enforcement.
This is getting back to this issue of revocation and timestamps in the in the logic. Yeah.
Thanks.
So as Steve says, he'll be around until July.